There was Gilbert Catface, a bad-tempered old fighter with an unfashionable beard and long whiskers, past 40 years but still tough. Rafe of Lyme, who spent more on clothes than on a bride, today wearing a blue cloak with a red silk lining. Jack Fitzguillaume, already a knight, although hardly older than William, and several others whose faces were vaguely familiar. He nodded in their general direction, but they took little notice of him. He was well known, but he was too young to be important. He turned and looked around the other side of the hall and saw Aliena immediately. She looked quite different today. Yesterday she had been dressed up for the cathedral in silk and fine wool and linen, with rings and ribbons and pointed boots. Today she wore the short tunic of a peasant woman or a child, and her feet were bare. She was sitting on a bench, studying a game board on which were counters of different colours. As William watched, she hitched up her tunic and crossed her legs, revealing her knees, and then wrinkled her nose in a frown. Yesterday she had been formidably sophisticated. Today she was a vulnerable child, and William found her even more desirable. He suddenly felt ashamed that this child had been able to cause him so much distress, and he yearned for some way of showing her that he could master her. It was a feeling almost like lust. She was playing with a boy 3 years or so younger than she. He had a restless, impatient look. He did not like the game. William could see a family resemblance between the two players. Indeed, the boy looked like Aliena as William remembered her from childhood, with a snub nose and short hair. This must be her younger brother Richard, the heir to the earldom. William went closer. Richard glanced up at him, then returned his attention to the board. Aliena was concentrating. Their painted wooden board was shaped like a cross and divided into squares of different colours. The counters appeared to be made of ivory, white, and black. The game was obviously a variant of Merrill's, or Nine Men's Morris, and probably a gift brought back from Normandy by Aliena's father. William was more interested in Aliena. When she leaned forward over the board, the neck of her tunic bowed out, and he could see the tops of her breasts. They were as large as he had imagined. His mouth went dry. Richard moved a counter on the board, and Aliena said, "No, you can't do that." The boy was put out. "Why not?" "Because it's against the rules, stupid." "I don't like the rules," Richard said petulantly. Aliena flared up. "You have to obey the rules." "Why do I? You just do, that's why." "Well, I don't," he said, and he tipped the board off the bench onto the floor, sending the counters flying. Quick as a flash, Aliena slapped his face. He cried out, his pride as well as his face stung. "You—" he hesitated. "You devil fucker!" he shouted. He turned and ran away, but after 3 steps he cannoned into William. William picked him up by one arm and held him in midair. "Don't let the priest hear you call your sister such names," he said. Richard wriggled and squealed. "You're hurting me! Let me go!" William held him a little longer. Richard stopped struggling and began to cry. William put him down, and he ran off in tears. Aliena was staring at William, her game forgotten, a puzzled frown wrinkling her brow. "Why are you here?" she said. Her voice was low and calm, the voice of an older person. William sat on the bench, feeling rather pleased about the masterful way he had dealt with Richard. "I've come to see you," he said. A wary look came over her face. "Why?" William positioned himself so that he could watch the staircase. He saw, coming down into the hall, a man in his 40s dressed like a high-ranking servant in a round cap and a short tunic of fine cloth. The servant gestured to someone, and a knight and a man-at-arms went up the stairs together. William looked at Aliena again. "I want to talk to you." "About what?" "About you and me." Over her shoulder he saw the servant approaching them. There was something a little effeminate about the man's walk. In one hand he carried a loaf of sugar, dirty brown in colour and cone-shaped. In his other hand was a twisted root that looked like ginger. The man was obviously the household steward, and he had been to the spice safe, a locked cupboard in the Earl's bedroom, for the day's supplies of precious ingredients, which he was now taking to the cook. Sugar to sweeten a crabapple tart, perhaps, and ginger to flavour lampreys. Aliena followed William's gaze.
"Oh, hello, Matthew."
The steward smiled and broke off a piece of sugar for her. William had a feeling that Matthew was very fond of Aliena. Something in her demeanour must have told him that she was uncomfortable, for his smile turned to a concerned frown, and he said, "Is everything all right?" His voice was soft.
"Yes, thank you."
Matthew looked at William, and his face registered surprise.
"Young William Hamley, isn't it?"
William was embarrassed to be recognized, even though it was inevitable. "Keep your sugar for the children," he said, although he had not been offered any. "I don't care for it."
"Very well, Lord."
Matthew's look said that he had not got where he was today by making trouble for the sons of the gentry. He turned back to Aliena.
"Your father brought back some wonderful soft silk. I'll show you later."
"Thank you," she said. Matthew went away. William said, "Effeminate fool." Aliena said,
"Why were you so rude to him?"
"I don't let servants call me young William." This was not a good way to begin wooing a lady. William realized with a sinking feeling that he had got off to a bad start. He had to be charming. He smiled and said, "If you were my wife, my servants would call you lady."
"Did you come here to talk about marriage?" she said,
and William thought he detected a note of incredulity in her voice.
"You don't know me,"
William said in a tone of protest. He was failing to keep this conversation under control, he realized miserably. He had planned a little small talk before getting down to business, but she was so direct and candid that he was forced to blurt out his message.
"You misjudged me. I don't know what I did last time we met to make you dislike me, but whatever your reason, you were too hasty."
She looked away, considering her reply. Behind her, William saw the knight and the man-at-arms come down the stairs and go out through the door, looking purposeful. A moment later, a man in clerical robes, presumably the Earl's secretary, appeared from above and beckoned. Two knights got up and went upstairs, Ralph of Lyme, flashing the red lining of his cloak, and an older man with a bald head. Clearly, the men waiting in the hall were seeing the Earl in ones and twos in his chamber. But why? "After all this time," Aliena was saying. She was suppressing some emotion. It might have been anger, but William had a sneaking feeling it was laughter.
"After all the trouble and anger and scandal, just when it's dying down at last, now you tell me I made a mistake."
When she put it that way, it did seem a bit implausible, William realized. "It hasn't died down at all. People are still talking about it, my mother is still furious, and my father can't hold his head up in public," he said wildly. "It's not over for us."
"This is all about family honour for you, isn't it?"
There was a dangerous note in her voice, but William ignored it. He had just realized what the Earl must be doing with all these knights and men-at-arms. He was sending messages.
"Family honour," he said distractedly. "Yes. I know I ought to think about honour and alliances between families and all that," Aliena said, "but that's not all there is to marriage."
She seemed to ponder for a moment, then reach a decision.
"Perhaps I should tell you about my mother. She hated my father. My father isn't a bad man. In fact, he's a great man, and I love him. But he's dreadfully solemn and strict, and he never understood mother. She was a happy, light-hearted person who loved to laugh and tell stories and have music, and father made her miserable."
There were tears in Aliena's eyes, William noted vaguely, but he was thinking about messages.
"That's why she died. Because he wouldn't let her be happy. I know it. And he knows it too, you see. That's why he promised he would never make me marry someone I don't like. Do you understand now?"
"Those messages are orders," William was thinking, "orders to Earl Bartholomew's friends and allies, warning them to get ready to fight, and the messengers are evidence." He realized Aliena was staring at him.
Marry someone you don't like, he said, echoing her final words. Don't you like me? Her eyes flashed anger. You haven't been listening, she said. You're so self-centered that you can't think about anyone else's feelings for a moment. Last time you came here, what did you do? You talked and talked about yourself and never asked me one question.
Her voice had risen to a shout, and when she stopped, William noticed that the men on the other side of the room had fallen silent, listening. He felt embarrassed.
Not so loud, he said to her.
She took no notice.
You want to know why I don't like you? All right, I'll tell you. I don't like you because you have no refinement. I don't like you because you can hardly read. I don't like you because you're only interested in your dogs and your horses and yourself.
Gilbert Catface and Jack Fitzguillaume were laughing aloud now. William felt his face reddening. Those men were nobodies. They were knights. And they were laughing at him, the son of Lord Percy Hamley. He stood up.
All right,
he said urgently, trying to stop Aliena. It was no good. I don't like you because you're selfish, dull, and stupid, she yelled. All the knights were laughing now.
I dislike you, I despise you, I hate you, and I loathe you, and that's why I won't marry you.
The knights cheered and applauded. William cringed inside. Their laughter made him feel small, weak, and helpless, like a little boy, and when he was a little boy he had been frightened all the time. He turned away from Aliena, fighting to control his facial expression and hide his feelings. He crossed the room as fast as he could without running, while the laughter grew louder. At last he reached the door, flung it open, and stumbled out. He slammed it behind him and ran down the stairs, choking with shame, and the fading sound of their derisive laughter rang in his ears all the way across the muddy courtyard to the gate. The path from Earl's Castle to Shiring crossed a main road after about a mile. At the crossroads a traveller could turn north for Gloucester and the Welsh border, or south for Winchester and the coast. William and Walter turned south. William's anguish had turned to rage. He was too furious to speak. He wanted to hurt Aliena and kill all those knights. He would have liked to thrust his sword into each laughing mouth and drive it down each throat. And he had thought of a way to avenge himself on at least one of them. If it worked, he would get the proof he needed at the same time. The prospect gave him savage consolation. First, he had to catch one of them. As soon as the road ran into woodland, William dismounted and began to walk, leading his horse. Walter followed in silence, respecting his mood. William came to a narrower stretch of track and stopped. He turned to Walter and said, "Who's better with a knife? You or me?"
"Fighting at close quarters, I'm better," Walter said guardedly. "But you throw more accurately, Lord." They all called him Lord when he was angry.
"I suppose you can trip a bolting horse and make him fall?" William said.
"Yes, with a good stout pole."
"Go and find a small tree, then, and pull it up and trim it. Then you'll have a good stout pole."
Walter went off. William led the two horses through the woods and tied them up in a clearing a good way from the road. He took off their saddles and removed some of the cords and straps from the tack, enough to bind a man hand and foot with a little over. His plan was crude, but there was no time to devise something more elaborate, so he would have to hope for the best. On his way back to the road he found a stout piece of oak deadfall, dry and hard, to use as a club. Walter was waiting with his pole. William selected the place where the groom would lie in wait, behind the broad trunk of a beech tree that grew close to the path. "Don't shove the pole out too soon, or the horse will jump over it," he cautioned. "But don't leave it too late, because you can't trip him by his back legs. The ideal is to push it between his forelegs, and try to stick the end into the ground so he doesn't kick it aside."
Walter nodded. "I've seen this done before."
William walked about 30 yards back toward Earl's Castle. His role would be to make sure the horse bolted, so that it would be going too fast to avoid Walter's pole. He hid himself as close to the road as he could. Sooner or later one of Earl Bartholomew's messengers would come along. William hoped it would be soon. He was anxious about whether this was going to work, and he was impatient to get it over with. Those knights had no idea, while they were laughing at me, that I was spying on them, he thought, and it soothed him a little. But one of them is about to find out, and then he'll be sorry he laughed. Then he'll wish he had gone down on his knees and kissed my boots instead of laughing. He's going to weep and beg and plead with me to forgive him, and I'm just going to hurt him all the more. He had other consolations. If his plan worked out, it might ultimately bring about the downfall of Earl Bartholomew and the resurrection of the Hamleys. Then all those who had snickered at the cancelled wedding would tremble in fear, and some of them would suffer more than fear. The downfall of Bartholomew would also be the downfall of Aliena, and that was the best part. Her swollen pride and her superior manner would have to change after her father had been hanged as a traitor. If she wanted soft silk and sugar cones then, she would have to marry William to get them. He imagined her humble and contrite, bringing him a hot pastry from the kitchen, looking up at him with those big dark eyes, eager to please him, hoping for a caress, her soft mouth slightly open, begging to be kissed. His fantasy was disturbed by hoofbeats on the winter-hard mud of the road. He drew his knife and hefted it, reminding himself of its weight and balance. At the point, it was sharpened on both sides for better penetration. He stood upright, flattened his back against the tree that concealed him, held the knife by the blade, and waited, hardly breathing. He was nervous. He was afraid he might miss with the knife, or the horse might not fall, or the rider might kill Walter with a lucky stroke, so that William would have to fight him alone. Something bothered him about the hoofbeats as they came closer. He saw Walter peering at him through the vegetation with a worried frown. He had heard it too. Then William realized what it was. There was more than one horse. He had to make a quick decision. Would they attack two people? That might be too much like a fair fight. He decided to let them go and wait for a lone rider. It was disappointing, but this was the wisest course. He waved a hand at Walter in a wiping-out gesture. Walter nodded understanding and sank back under cover. A moment later, two horses came into view. William saw a flash of red silk, Rafe of lime. Then he saw the bald head of Rafe's companion. The two men trotted past and disappeared from view. Despite the sense of anticlimax, William was gratified to have confirmation of his theory that the Earl was sending these men out on errands. However, he wondered anxiously whether Bartholomew might have a policy of sending them in pairs. It would be a natural precaution. Everyone travelled in groups when possible, for safety. On the other hand, Bartholomew had a lot of messages and a limited number of men, and he might see it as an extravagance to use two knights to take one message. Furthermore, the knights were violent men who could be relied upon to give the average outlaw a hard fight, a fight from which the outlaw would gain little, because a knight did not have much worth stealing other than his sword, which was hard to sell without answering awkward questions, and his horse, which was liable to be crippled in the ambush. A knight was safer than most people in the forest. William scratched his head with the hilt of his knife. It could go either way. He settled down to wait. The forest was quiet. A feeble winter sun came out, shone fitfully through the dense greenery for a while, and then disappeared. William's belly reminded him that it was past dinner time. A deer crossed the path a few yards away, unaware that she was watched by a hungry man. William became impatient. If another pair of riders came along, he decided, he would have to attack. It was risky, but he had the advantage of surprise, and he had Walter, who was a formidable fighter. Besides, it might be his last chance. He knew he could get killed, and he was afraid, but that might be better than living on in constant humiliation. At least it was an honorable end to die in a fight. What would be best of all, he thought, would be for Aliena to appear all alone, cantering on a white pony. She would come crashing off the horse, bruising her arms and legs, and tumble into a bramble thicket. The thorns would scratch her soft skin, drawing blood. William would jump on top of her and pin her to the ground. She would be mortified. He played with that idea, elaborating her injuries, relishing the way her chest heaved up and down as he sat astride her, and imagining the expression of abject terror on her face when she realized she was completely in his power. And then he heard hoofbeats again. This time there was only one horse. He straightened up, took out his knife, pressed his back against the tree and listened again. It was a good, fast horse, not a war horse, but probably a solid courser. It was carrying a moderate weight, such as a man with no armor, and coming at a steady all-day trot, not even breathing hard. William caught Walter's eye and nodded. This was the one. Here was the evidence. He raised his right arm, holding the knife by the tip of the blade. In the distance, William's own horse whinnied. The sound carried clearly through the still forest and was perfectly audible over the light tattoo of the approaching horse. The horse heard it and broke its stride. Its rider said, "Whoa!" and slowed it to a walk. William cursed under his breath. The rider would be wary now, and that would make everything more difficult. Too late, William wished he had taken his own horse farther away. He could not tell how far away the approaching horse was now that it was walking. Everything was going wrong. He resisted the temptation to look out from behind his tree. He listened hard, taut with strain. Suddenly he heard the horse snort, shockingly close, and then it appeared a yard from where he stood. It saw him a moment after he saw it. It shied, and the rider let out a grunt of surprise. William cursed. He realized instantly that the horse might turn and bolt the wrong way. He ducked back behind the tree and came out on the other side, behind the horse, with his throwing arm raised. He caught a glimpse of the rider, bearded and frowning as he tugged at the reins. It was tough old Gilbert Catface. William threw the knife. It was a perfect throw. The knife struck the horse's rump point first and sank an inch or more into its flesh. The horse seemed to start, as a man does when shocked. Then, before Gilbert could react, it broke into a panic-stricken gallop and took off at top speed, heading straight for Walter's ambush. William ran after it. The horse covered the distance to where Walter was in a few moments. Gilbert was making no effort to control his mount. He was too busy trying to stay in the saddle. They drew level with Walter's position, and William thought, "Now, Walter, now!" Walter timed his move so finely that William never actually saw the pole shoot out from behind the tree. He just saw the horse's forelegs crumple, as if all the strength had left them suddenly. Then its hind legs seemed to catch up with its forelegs, so that they all became entangled. Finally, its head went down, its hindquarters went up, and it fell heavily. Gilbert flew through the air. Going after him, William was brought up short by the fallen horse. Gilbert landed well, rolled over and got to his knees. For a moment, William was afraid he might run off and escape. Then Walter came out of the undergrowth, launched himself through the air, and cannoned into Gilbert's back, knocking him flat. Both men hit the ground hard. They recovered their balance at the same time, and William saw to his horror that the wily Gilbert had come up with a knife in his hand. William leaped over the fallen horse and swung the oak club at Gilbert just as Gilbert raised his knife. The club hit the side of Gilbert's head. Gilbert staggered but got to his feet. William damned him for being so tough. William drew back the club for another swing, but Gilbert was faster and lunged at William with the knife. William was dressed for courting, not fighting, and the sharp blade sliced through his fine wool cloak. But he jumped back quickly enough to save his skin. Gilbert continued coming at him, keeping him off balance, so that he could not wield the club. Each time Gilbert lunged, William jumped back, but William never had quite enough time to recover, and Gilbert rapidly closed on him. Suddenly, William was afraid for his life. Then Walter came up behind Gilbert and kicked his legs from under him. William sagged with relief. For a moment there, he had thought he was going to die. He thanked God for Walter. Gilbert tried to get up, but Walter kicked him in the face. William hit him with the club twice for good measure, and after that Gilbert lay still. They rolled him onto his front, and Walter sat on his head while William tied his hands behind his back. Then William took off Gilbert's long black boots and bound his bare ankles together with a strong piece of leather harness. He stood up. He grinned at Walter, and Walter smiled. It was a relief to have this slippery old fighter securely tied up. The next step was to make Gilbert confess. He was coming round. Walter turned him over. When Gilbert saw William, he registered recognition, then surprise, then fear. William was gratified. Gilbert was already regretting his laughter, William thought. In a while, he was going to regret it even more. Gilbert's horse was on its feet, remarkably. It had run a few yards off, but had stopped and was now looking back, breathing hard and starting every time the wind rustled in the trees. William's knife had fallen out of its rump. William picked up his knife, and Walter went to catch the horse. William was listening for the sound of riders. Another messenger might come along at any moment. If that happened, Gilbert would have to be dragged out of sight and kept quiet. But no riders came, and Walter was able to catch Gilbert's horse without too much difficulty. They slung Gilbert across the back of his horse, then led it through the forest to where William had left their own mounts. The other horses became agitated when they smelled the blood seeping from the wound in Gilbert's horse's rump, so William tethered it a little way off. He looked around for a tree suitable to his purpose. He located an elm with a stout branch protruding at a height of 8 or 9 feet off the ground. He pointed it out to Walter. "I want to suspend Gilbert from this bough," he said. Walter grinned sadistically. "What are you going to do to him, Lord?"
"You'll see."
Gilbert's leathery face was white with fear. William passed a rope under the man's armpits, tied it behind his back, and looped it over the branch. "Lift him," he said to Walter. Walter hoisted Gilbert. Gilbert wriggled and got free of Walter's grasp, falling on the ground. Walter picked up William's club and beat Gilbert about the head until he was groggy, then picked him up again. William threw the loose end of the rope over the branch several times and pulled it tight. Walter released Gilbert, and he swung gently from the branch with his feet a yard off the ground. "Collect some firewood," William said. They built a fire under Gilbert, and William lit it with a spark from a flint. After a few moments, the flames began to rise. The heat brought Gilbert out of his daze. When he realized what was happening to him, he began to moan in terror. "Please," he said, "please let me down. I'm sorry I laughed at you. Please have mercy." William was silent. Gilbert's groveling was very satisfying, but it was not what William was after. When the heat began to hurt Gilbert's bare toes, he bent his legs at the knee to take his feet out of the fire. His face was running with sweat, and there was a faint smell of scorching as his clothes got hot. William judged it was time to start the interrogation. He said, "Why did you go to the castle today?" Gilbert stared, wide-eyed, at him.
"To pay my respects," he said. "Does it matter?"
"Why did you go to pay your respects?"
"The Earl has just returned from Normandy."
"You weren't summoned especially?"
"No."
It might be true, William reflected. Interrogating a prisoner was not as straightforward as he had imagined. He thought again. "What did the Earl say to you when you went up to his chamber?"
"He greeted me, and thanked me for coming to welcome him home."
Was there a look of wary comprehension in Gilbert's eyes? William was not sure. He said, "What else?"
"He asked after my family and my village."
"Nothing else?"
"Nothing. Why do you care what he said?"
"What did he say to you about King Stephen and the Empress Maud?"
"Nothing, I tell you."
Gilbert could not keep his knees bent any longer, and his feet fell back into the growing flames. After a second, a yell of agony burst from him, and his body convulsed. The spasm took his feet out of the flames momentarily. He realized then that he could ease the pain by swinging to and fro. With each swing, however, he passed through the flames and cried out again. Once more, William wondered whether Gilbert might be telling the truth. There was no way of knowing. At some point, presumably, he would be in so much agony that he would say whatever he thought William wanted him to say, in a desperate attempt to get some relief. So it was important not to give him too clear an idea of what was wanted, William thought worriedly. Who would have thought that torturing people could be so difficult? He made his voice calm and almost conversational. Where are you going now? Gilbert screamed in pain and frustration.
What does it matter?
Where are you going?
Home!
The man was losing his grip. William knew where he lived, and it was north of here. He had been heading in the wrong direction. Where are you going? William said again.
What do you want from me?
I know when you're lying, William said. Just tell me the truth. He heard Walter give a low grunt of approval, and he thought, I'm getting better at this. Where are you going? He said, for the fourth time. Gilbert became too exhausted to swing himself any more. Groaning in pain, he came to a stop over the fire, and once more bent his legs to take his feet out of the flames. But now the fire was burning high enough to singe his knees. William noticed a smell, vaguely familiar but also slightly sickening, and after a moment he realized it was the smell of burning flesh, and it was familiar because it was like the smell of dinner. The skin of Gilbert's legs and feet was turning brown and cracking, the hairs on his shins going black, and fat from his flesh dripped into the fire and sizzled. Watching his agony mesmerized William. Every time Gilbert cried out, William felt a profound thrill. He had the power of pain over a man, and it made him feel good. It was a bit like the way he felt when he got a girl, alone, in a place where nobody could hear her protest, and pinned her to the ground, pulling her skirts up around her waist, and knew that nothing could now stop him from having her. Almost reluctantly, he said again, "Where are you going?" In a voice that was a suppressed scream, Gilbert said,
"To Sherborne."
"Why?"
"Cut me down, for the love of Christ Jesus, and I'll tell you everything."
William sensed victory within his grasp. It was deeply satisfying. But he was not quite there yet. He said to Walter, "Just pull his feet out of the fire." Walter grabbed Gilbert's tunic and pulled on it so that his legs were clear of the flames. "Now," William said,
"Earl Bartholomew has 50 knights in and around Sherborne,"
Gilbert said in a strangled cry.
"I am to muster them and bring them to Earl's castle."
William smiled. All his guesses were proving gratifyingly accurate. "And what is the Earl planning to do with these knights?"
"He didn't say."
William said to Walter, "Let him burn a little more."
"No!"
Gilbert screamed.
"I'll tell you!"
Walter hesitated. "Quickly," William warned.
"They are to fight for the Empress Maud against Stephen,"
Gilbert said at last. That was it. That was the proof. William savored his success. "And when I ask you this in front of my father, will you answer the same?" he said.
"Yes, yes."
"And when my father asks you in front of the king, will you still tell the truth?"
"Yes."
"Swear by the cross."
"I swear by the cross, I'll tell the truth."
"Amen," William said contentedly, and he began to stamp out the fire. They tied Gilbert to his saddle and put his horse on a leading rein, then rode on at a walk. The knight was barely able to stay upright, and William did not want him to die, for he was no use dead, so he tried not to treat him too roughly. Next time they passed a stream, he threw cold water over the knight's burned feet. Gilbert screamed in pain, but it probably did him good. William felt a wonderful sense of triumph, mingled with an odd kind of frustration. He had never killed a man, and he wished he could kill Gilbert. Torturing a man without killing him was like stripping a girl naked without raping her. The more he thought about that, the more he felt the need of a woman. Perhaps when he got home. No, there would be no time. He would have to tell his parents what had happened, and they would want Gilbert to repeat his confession in front of a priest, and perhaps some other witnesses, and then they would have to plan the capture of Earl Bartholomew, which would surely have to take place tomorrow, before Bartholomew mustered too many fighting men. And still William had not thought of a way to take that castle by stealth without a prolonged siege. He was thinking with frustration that it might be a long time before he even saw an attractive woman, when one appeared on the road ahead. There were 5 people in a group, walking toward William. One of them was a dark-haired woman of about 25 years, not exactly a girl, but young enough. As she came closer, William became more interested. She was quite beautiful, with dark brown hair that came to a devil's peak on her brow, and deep-set eyes of an intense golden colour. She had a trim, lithe figure and smooth, tanned skin. "Stay back," William said to Walter. "Keep the knight behind you while I talk to them." The group stopped and looked warily at him. They were a family, obviously. There was a tall man who was presumably the husband, a lad who was full-grown but not yet bearded, and a couple of sprats. The man looked familiar, William realized with a start. "Do I know you?" he said.
"I know you," the man said, "and I know your horse, for together you almost killed my daughter."
It began to come back to William. His horse had not touched the child, but it had been close.
"You were building my house," he said, "and when I dismissed you, you demanded payment, and almost threatened me."
The man looked defiant and did not deny it.
"You're not so cocky now,"
William said with a sneer. The whole family appeared to be starving. It was turning out to be a good day for settling accounts with people who had offended William Hamley.
"Are you hungry?"
"Yes, we're hungry," said the builder in a tone of sullen anger.
William looked again at the woman. She stood with her feet a little apart and her chin up, staring at him fearlessly. He had been inflamed by Aliena, and now he wanted to slake his lust with this one. She would be lively, he felt sure. She would wriggle and scratch. All the better.
"You're not married to this girl, are you, builder?" he said. "I remember your wife, an ugly cow."
The shadow of pain crossed the builder's face, and he said,
"My wife died."
"And you haven't taken this one to church, have you? You haven't got a penny to pay the priest."
Behind William, Walter coughed, and the horses moved impatiently.
"Suppose I give you money for food,"
William said to the builder, to tantalize him.
"I'll accept it gratefully," the man said, although William could tell it hurt him to be subservient.
"I'm not talking about a gift.
I'll buy your woman."
The woman herself spoke. "I'm not for sale, boy." Her scorn was well directed, and William was angered. "I'll show you whether I'm a man or a boy," he thought, "when I get you alone." He spoke to the builder.
"I'll give you a pound of silver for her."
"She's not for sale."
William's anger grew. It was infuriating to offer a fortune to a starving man and be turned down. He said,
"You fool.
If you don't take the money, I'll run you through with my sword and fuck her in front of the children."
The builder's arm moved under his cloak. He must have some kind of weapon, William thought. He was also very big, and although he was as thin as a knife, he might put up a mean fight to save his woman. The woman moved her cloak aside and rested her hand on the hilt of a surprisingly long dagger at her belt. The older boy was big enough to cause trouble, too. Walter spoke in a low but carrying voice.
"Lord, there's no time for this."
William nodded reluctantly. He had to get Gilbert back to the Hamley Manor House. It was too important to delay with a brawl over a woman. He would just have to suffer. He looked at the little family of five ragged, hungry people, ready to fight to the finish against two beefy men with horses and swords. He could not understand them.
"All right, then, starve to death," he said.
He kicked his horse and trotted on, and a few moments later they were out of sight. 2. When they were a mile or so from the place where they had encountered William Hamley, Ellen said,
"Can we slow down now?"
Tom realized he had been setting a fierce pace. He had been frightened. For a moment back there, it had looked as if he and Alfred would have to fight two armed men on horseback. Tom did not even have a weapon. He had reached under his cloak for his mason's hammer, and then remembered, painfully, that he had sold it weeks ago for a sack of oats. He was not sure why William had backed off in the end, but he wanted to put as much distance as possible between them in case the young lord changed his evil little mind. Tom had failed to find work at the palace of the Bishop of Kingsbridge, and at every other place he had tried. However, there was a quarry in the vicinity of Shiring, and a quarry, unlike a building site, employed as many men in winter as it did in summer. Of course, Tom's usual work was more skilled and better paid than quarrying, but he was a long way past caring about that. He just wanted to feed his family. The quarry at Shiring was owned by Earl Bartholomew, and Tom had been told that the Earl could be found at his castle a few miles to the west of the town. Now that he had Ellen, he was even more desperate than before. He knew that she had thrown her lot in with him for love, and had not weighed the consequences carefully. In particular, she did not have a clear idea of how difficult it might be for Tom to get work. She had not really confronted the possibility that they might not survive the winter, and Tom held back from disillusioning her, for he wanted her to stay with him. But a woman was liable to put her child before everything else in the end, and Tom was afraid Ellen would leave him. They had been together a week, 7 days of despair and 7 nights of joy. Every morning Tom woke up feeling happy and optimistic. As the day wore on, he would get hungry, the children would tire, and Ellen would become morose. Some days they got fed, like the time they met the monk with the cheese, and some days they chewed on strips of sun-dried venison from Ellen's reserve. It was like eating deer hide, but it was better than nothing, just. But when it got dark, they would lie down, cold and miserable, and hold one another close for warmth. Then after a while they would start stroking and kissing. At first Tom had always wanted to enter her immediately, but she refused him gently. She wanted to play and kiss much longer. He did it her way and was enchanted. He explored her body boldly, caressing her in places where he had never touched Agnes, her armpits and her ears and the cleft of her buttocks. Some nights they giggled together, with their heads beneath their cloaks. At other times they felt very tender. One night, when they were alone in the guest house of a monastery and the children were in an exhausted sleep, she was dominant and insistent, commanding him to do things to her, showing him how to excite her with his fingers, and he complied, feeling bemused and inflamed by her shamelessness. When it was all over, they would fall into a deep, restful sleep, with the day's fear and anger washed away by love. It was now midday. Tom judged that William Hamley was far away, so he decided to stop for a rest. They had no food other than the dried venison. However, this morning they had begged some bread at a lonely farmhouse, and the woman had given them some ale in a big wooden bottle with no stopper, and told them to keep the bottle. Ellen had saved half the ale for dinner. Tom sat on the edge of a broad old tree stump, and Ellen sat beside him. She took a long draught of the ale and passed it to him. "Do you want some meat as well?" she asked. He shook his head and drank some ale. He could easily have swallowed it all, but he left some for the children. "Save the meat," he said to Ellen. "We may get supper at the castle." Alfred put the bottle to his mouth and drained it. Jack looked crestfallen, and Martha burst into tears. Alfred gave an odd little grin. Ellen looked at Tom. After a few moments she said, "You shouldn't let Alfred get away with that." Tom shrugged. "He's bigger than they are. He needs it more. He always gets a large share anyway. The little ones must have something." "It's a waste of time to interfere in children's quarrels," Tom said. Ellen's voice became harsh. "You're saying that Alfred can bully the younger children as much as he likes, and you will do nothing about it?"
"He doesn't bully them," Tom said. "Children always fight."
She shook her head, seeming bewildered.
"I don't understand you. In every other way you're a kind man, but when Alfred is concerned you're just blind."
She was exaggerating, Tom felt, but he did not want to displease her, so he said, "Give the little ones some meat, then." Ellen opened her bag. She still looked cross. She cut off a strip of dried venison for Martha and another for Jack. Alfred held out his hand for some, but Ellen ignored him. Tom thought she should have given him some. There was nothing wrong with Alfred. Ellen just did not understand him. He was a big boy, Tom thought proudly. And he had a big appetite and a quick temper, and if that was a sin, then half the adolescent boys in the world were damned. They rested for a while and then walked on. Jack and Martha went ahead, still chewing the leathery meat. The two young ones got on well, despite the difference in their ages. Martha was 6 and Jack was probably 11 or 12. But Martha thought Jack was utterly fascinating, and Jack seemed to be enjoying the novel experience of having another child to play with. It was a pity that Alfred did not like Jack. This surprised Tom. He would have expected that Jack, who was not yet becoming a man, would be beneath Alfred's contempt, but it was not so. Alfred was the stronger, of course, but little Jack was clever. Tom refused to worry about it. They were just boys. He had too much on his mind to waste time fretting over children's squabbles. Sometimes he wondered secretly whether he would ever get work again. He might go on tramping the roads day after day, until one by one they died off. A child found cold and lifeless one frosty morning, another too weak to fight off a fever. Ellen ravished and killed by a passing thug like William Hamley, and Tom himself becoming thinner and thinner, until one day he was too weak to stand up in the morning, and lay on the forest floor until he slipped into unconsciousness. Ellen would leave him before that happened, of course. She would return to her cave, where there was still a barrel of apples and a sack of nuts, enough to keep two people alive until the spring, but not enough for 5. Tom would be heartbroken if she did that. He wondered how the baby was. The monks had called him Jonathan. Tom liked the name. It meant a gift from God, according to the monk with the cheese. Tom pictured little Jonathan red and wrinkled and bald, the way he was born. He would be different now. A week was a long time for a newborn baby. He would be bigger already, and his eyes would open wider. Now he would no longer be oblivious to the world around him. A loud noise would make him jump, and a lullaby would soothe him. When he needed to burp, his mouth would curl up at the corners. The monks probably would not know that it was wind and would take it for a real smile. Tom hoped they were caring for him well. The monk with the cheese had given the impression that they were kindly and capable men. Anyway, they were certainly better able to look after the baby than Tom, who was homeless and penniless. "If I ever become master of a really big construction project and earn 48 pence a week plus allowances, I'll give money to that monastery," he thought. They emerged from the forest, and soon afterward they came within sight of the castle. Tom's spirits lifted, but he repressed his enthusiasm fiercely. He had suffered months of disappointment, and he had learned that the more hopeful he was at the start, the more painful was the rejection at the end. They approached the castle on a path through bare fields. Martha and Jack came upon an injured bird, and they all stopped to look. It was a wren, so small that they might easily have missed it. Martha stooped over it, and it hopped away, apparently unable to fly. She caught it and picked it up, cradling the tiny creature in her cupped hands. "It's trembling," she said. "I can feel it. It must be frightened." The bird made no further attempt to escape, but sat still in Martha's hands, its bright eyes gazing at the people all around. Jack said, "I think it's got a broken wing." Alfred said, "Let me see." He took the bird from her.
"We could take care of it," Martha said. "Perhaps it will get better."
"No, it won't," Alfred said. With a quick motion of his big hands, he wrung the bird's neck. Ellen said, "Oh, for God's sake!" Martha burst into tears for the second time that day. Alfred laughed and dropped the bird on the ground. Jack picked it up.
"Dead," he said.
Ellen said,
"What is wrong with you, Alfred?"
Tom said, "Nothing's wrong with him. The bird was going to die." He walked on and the others followed. Ellen was angry with Alfred again, and it made Tom cross. Why make a fuss about a damned wren? Tom remembered what it was like to be 14 years old, a boy with the body of a man. Life was frustrating. Ellen had said, "Where Alfred is concerned, you're just blind." But she did not understand. The wooden bridge that led over the moat to the gatehouse was flimsy and ramshackle, but that was probably how the Earl liked it. A bridge was a means of access for attackers, and the more readily it fell down, the safer the castle was. The perimeter walls were of earth with stone towers at intervals. Ahead of them, as they crossed the bridge, was a stone gatehouse, like two towers with a connecting walkway. Plenty of stonework here, Tom thought. Not one of these castles that are all mud and wood. Tomorrow I could be working. He remembered the feel of good tools in his hands, the scrape of the chisel across a block of stone as he squared its sides and smoothed its face, the dry feel of the dust in his nostrils. Tomorrow night my belly may be full, with food I've earned, not begged. Coming closer, he noticed with his mason's eye that the battlements on top of the gatehouse were in bad condition. Some of the big stones had fallen, leaving the parapet quite level in parts. There were also loose stones in the arch of the gateway. There were two sentries at the gate, and both looked alert. Perhaps they were expecting trouble. One of them asked Tom his business. "Stonemason, hoping to be hired to work in the Earl's quarry," he replied. "Look for the Earl's steward," the sentry said helpfully. "His name is Matthew. You'll probably find him in the Great Hall." "Thanks," Tom said. "What kind of a man is he?" The guard grinned at his colleague and said, "Not much of a man at all," and they both laughed. Tom supposed he would soon find out what that meant. He went in, and Ellen and the children followed. The buildings within the walls were mostly wooden, though some were raised on stone skirtings, and there was one built all of stone that was probably the chapel. As they crossed the compound, Tom noticed that the towers around the perimeter all had loose stones and damaged battlements. They crossed the second moat to the upper circle, and stopped at the second gatehouse. Tom told the guard he was looking for Matthew Steward. They all went on into the upper compound and approached the square stone keep. The wooden door at ground level clearly opened into the undercroft. They went up the wooden steps to the hall. Tom saw both the steward and the Earl as soon as he went in. He knew who they were by their clothes. Earl Bartholomew wore a long tunic with flared cuffs on the sleeves and embroidery on the hem. Matthew Steward wore a short tunic in the same style as the one Tom was wearing, but made of a softer cloth, and he had a little round cap. They were near the fireplace, the Earl sitting and the steward standing. Tom approached the two men and stood just out of earshot, waiting for them to notice him. Earl Bartholomew was a tall man of over 50, with white hair and a pale, thin, haughty face. He did not look like a man of generous spirit. The steward was younger. He stood in a way that reminded Tom of the guard's remark. It looked feminine. Tom was not sure what to make of him. There were several other people in the hall, but none of them took any notice of Tom. He waited, feeling hopeful and fearful by turns. The Earl's conversation with his steward seemed to take forever. At last it ended, and the steward bowed and turned aside. Tom stepped forward with his heart in his mouth. "Are you Matthew?" he said.
"Yes."
"My name is Tom, Master Mason. I'm a good craftsman, and my children are starving. I hear you have a quarry." He held his breath.
"We have a quarry, but I don't think we need any more quarrymen," Matthew said.
He glanced back at the Earl, who shook his head almost imperceptibly.
"No," Matthew said, "we can't hire you."
It was the speed of the decision that broke Tom's heart. If people were solemn and thought hard about it and rejected him regretfully, he could bear it more easily. Matthew was not a cruel man, Tom could tell, but he was busy, and Tom and his starving family were just another item to be disposed of as quickly as possible. Tom said desperately, "I could do some repairs here at the castle."
"We have a Wright who does all that kind of work for us," Matthew said.
A Wright was a jack-of-all-trades, usually trained as a carpenter.
"I'm a mason," Tom said. "My walls are strong."
Matthew was annoyed with him for arguing and seemed about to say something angry. Then he looked at the children and his face softened again.
"I'd like to give you work, but we don't need you."
Tom nodded. He should now humbly accept what the steward had said, put on a pitiful look, and beg for a meal and a place to sleep for one night. But Ellen was with him, and he was afraid she would leave, so he gave it one more try. He said in a voice loud enough for the Earl to hear, "I just hope you're not expecting to do battle soon." The effect was much more dramatic than he had expected. Matthew gave a start, and the Earl got to his feet and said sharply,
Why do you say that?
Tom perceived he had touched a nerve.
Because your defences are in bad repair, he said.
In what way?
The Earl said. Be specific, man.
Tom took a deep breath. The Earl was irritated but attentive. Tom would not get another chance after this.
The mortar in the gatehouse walls has come away in places. This leaves an opening for a crowbar. An enemy could easily pry out a stone or two, and once there's a hole, it's easy to pull the wall down.
Also, he hurried on breathlessly before anyone could comment or argue, also, all your battlements are damaged. They're level in places. This leaves your archers and knights unprotected from—
I know what battlements are for, the Earl interrupted tetchily.
Anything else?
Yes. The keep has an undercroft with a wooden door. If I were attacking the keep, I'd go through that door and start a fire in the stores.
And if you were the Earl, how would you prevent that?
I'd have a pile of stones, ready-shaped, and a supply of sand and lime for mortar, and a mason standing by ready to block up that doorway in times of danger.
Earl Bartholomew stared at Tom. His pale blue eyes were narrowed, and there was a frown on his white forehead. Tom could not read his expression. Was he angry with Tom for being so critical of the castle defences? You could never tell how a lord would react to criticism. By and large, it was best to let them make their own mistakes. But Tom was a desperate man. At last the Earl seemed to reach a conclusion. He turned to Matthew and said, "Hire this man." A whoop of jubilation rose in Tom's throat, and he had to choke it back. He could hardly believe it. He looked at Ellen and they both smiled happily. Martha, who did not suffer from adult inhibitions, shouted, "Hooray!" Earl Bartholomew turned away and spoke to a knight standing nearby. Matthew smiled at Tom.
"Have you had dinner today?" he said.
Tom swallowed. He was so happy he felt close to tears.
"No, we haven't."
"I'll take you to the kitchen." Eagerly, they followed the steward out of the hall and across the bridge to the lower compound. The kitchen was a large wood building with a stone skirting. Matthew told them to wait outside. There was a sweet smell in the air. They were baking pastries in there. Tom's belly rumbled, and his mouth watered so much it hurt. After a moment, Matthew emerged with a big pot of ale and handed it to Tom. "They'll bring out some bread and cold bacon in a moment," he said. He left them. Tom took a swallow of the ale and passed the pot to Ellen. She gave some to Martha, then took a drink herself and passed it to Jack. Alfred made a grab for it before Jack could drink. Jack turned away, keeping the pot out of Alfred's reach. Tom did not want another quarrel between the children, not now when everything had turned out all right at last. He was about to intervene, thereby breaking his own rule about interference in children's squabbles, when Jack turned around again and meekly handed the pot to Alfred. Alfred put the pot to his mouth and began to drink. Tom had only taken a swallow, and he thought the pot would come around to him again. But Alfred looked set to drain it. Then a strange thing happened. As Alfred upended the pot to drink the last of the ale, something like a small animal fell out onto his face. Alfred gave a frightened yell and dropped the pot. He brushed the furry thing off his face, jumping back. "What is it?" he screeched. The thing fell to the floor. He stared down at it, white-faced and trembling with disgust. They all looked. It was the dead wren. Tom caught Ellen's eye, and they both looked at Jack. Jack had taken the pot from Ellen, then turned his back for a moment, as if trying to evade Alfred, then handed the pot to Alfred with surprising willingness. Now he stood quietly, looking at the horrified Alfred, with a faint smile of satisfaction on his clever, young old face. Jack knew he would suffer for that. Alfred would take his revenge somehow. When the others were not looking, Alfred would punch him in the stomach, perhaps. This was a favourite blow, for it was very painful but left no marks. Jack had seen him do it to Martha several times. But it had been worth a punch in the stomach just to see the shock and fear on Alfred's face when the dead bird fell out of his beer. Alfred hated Jack. This was a new experience for Jack. His mother had always loved him, and no one else had had any feelings for him. There was no apparent reason for Alfred's hostility. He seemed to feel much the same about Martha. He was always pinching her, pulling her hair, and tripping her, and he relished any opportunity to spoil something she valued. Jack's mother saw what was going on and hated it, but Alfred's father seemed to think it was all perfectly normal, even though he himself was a kind and gentle man who obviously loved Martha. The whole thing was baffling, but nonetheless fascinating. Everything was fascinating. Jack had never